Where are you, Brian? Are you in Brooklyn?
No, I'm in Miami.
Brian's not kind of a Brooklyn type. Have you ever lived in Brooklyn, Brian?
I lived in Dumbo, which isn't really Brooklyn. It's like a brand activation.
Yeah.
I'm so confused. I thought you gave up on Miami.
Well, we moved back to New York, but then Miami called us back. It's the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Fisher, where do you live?
I can see the Washington Monument from my window right now.
I lived in Washington for 2 years.
I know, I remember, but it wasn't your place.
I didn't love it, I gotta admit. But I don't think it bears much resemblance to when I was going to the Hawk and Dove. Is the Hawk and Dove still there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Phew. Tune in.
Tune in's there. These are my college bars.
I know. Well, I lived there when I was like 25. Should we get started?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, let's do it.
Welcome to a new edition of People versus Algorithms, a show about detecting patterns in media, technology, and culture. I'm Brian Marcy, and each week I'm normally joined by Troy Young and Alex Schleifer. This week, with Alex still traveling on the other side of the world, Axios senior media reporter Sarah Fisher joined Troy and I to break down the current state of the media business. Sarah has covered the media business for Axios for the past 7 years after starting her career on the sales side, which I think gives her a unique perspective that many journalists lack. Sarah's weekly newsletter, Media Trends, is a must-read. I've done a few podcasts with her over the years, including one earlier this year at Rebooting Show, another podcast I do. I encourage you to check that one out. During this episode, I noted how many of the headlines of Sarah's pieces were rather downbeat. And I often hear a plea from listeners and readers for more optimism in discussions of the media business. I hear you. I'm sympathetic to that. At the same time, I try to balance highlighting those undeniable bright spots with a dose of realism, because there is a growth story to tell in the media industry, and we talk about it in this episode. Too often, the struggles of legacy players obscure some of those bright spots, and there is a palpable feeling that exists, and it's just reality, that more shoes are going to drop in the media business as it undergoes yet another distribution disruption. As Troy notes in this episode, same as it ever was. One point that Sarah made that stands out is that creating distinctive journalism is being rewarded in the marketplace in some pockets, okay? It's often to say, make better journalism as a prescriptive. That's great, but it's more complicated. Beyond the New York Times success, and we discussed the now semi-viral chart about how much of the time spent with the New York Times brand is in non-news areas like gaming. You know, The Atlantic has made real progress in building a sustainable business through the strength of its journalism. It recently topped 1 million paid subscriptions, and it is now profitable. Imagine that. At the same time, the realist in me says that this isn't a solution for all legacy brands. The Atlantic playbook isn't necessarily the right one at other publications like Time, for instance, where the brand serves as more of a central node for other businesses such as experiential, awards franchises, a studio business, commerce, you name it. In this market, it doesn't pay to be sentimental. I mean, Time still does good journalistic work, such as its scoop late last year of a rift between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his top military commander. But Time, which took down its paywall last year, is pursuing a far different strategy, and that's okay. We're gonna need a bunch of different strategies. And we talk about that. And among the other topics we cover, why TikTok is winning, the death of aggregation as a competitive advantage, why social media is a big reason why women's sports is having a big moment right now, the New York Times as an extensible model or not, why the most promising growth areas still lie in niches, and future print magazines as marketing pieces. Now on to our conversation. All right. Sarah, thank you for joining us. Sarah, you're the senior media reporter at Axios. I think this is our third or fourth podcast together. You're a reliable draw and a wonderful conversation. So thank you for joining us. If this doesn't do well, it's all Troy's fault because we may be tested.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And you mean you can't fully blame Troy. If it doesn't work out, it could just be me.
I don't think so.
I don't think I sent you the time for the podcast. So there was a clerical error on my part.
Yeah.
which Brian's kind of annoyed
well
by,
Troy's but. One of those people who's had assistants for too long and then they're like with
my whole life assistant. Pretty much
they're adrift at sea. But luckily Sarah is like a true journalist who can just turn it on and be cogent and insightful about all these topics.
My favorite thing talking to I had breakfast with Sarah last week, and my favorite thing was when she was her sort of instinct around like how people actually consume media. Maybe it was a little bit of Axios book talking, but I think it was truth. It was truths. I just find it's maybe rare that even journalists are really reflective of how people actually want to or how they actually consume the news.
Okay. Well, lay it on us, Sarah. Yeah.
I mean, you had a lot of theories, Sarah.
I think more people are consuming TikTok and short form video than, you know, establishment press likes to think. And it's because, you know, we pour so much time, money, effort, resources into quality journalism. And the vast majority of what people want to hear about is Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce on TikTok or fashion trends. You know, we are just not in a period right now where people care a lot about politics and news compared to the 2016 Trump era where people were obsessed and fascinated. Like, we're just not there. And I think a lot of news organizations are sort of in denial. There are others that are not, and they're really leaning into lifestyle products because they get it. But there's just no way that one could say that this country is obsessed and fascinated with the news cycle like we used to be. We're just not.
But that was always a historical anomaly, wasn't it? I mean, 2016, Trump is an anomaly, and that period was anomalous to history. And I feel like people have been tuning this stuff out for a while. We used to hear all the time that people are apathetic and not paying attention. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, maybe you should pay attention a little less to politics.
Well, they're apathetic, I agree, and they have been. But what's different is we have such a wider array of media channels and things to absorb your attention than we did in the past when the news cycle was slower.
I think that's right. And I also think we had systematic delivery of a news update that was part of our sort of daily calendar in the past that meant we were all kind of had a baseline of information, I feel.
Yeah.
And now that's just not part of what we do. Like, nobody watches the 6 o'clock. I mean, maybe your parents do, but like not a lot of folks do that.
Yeah. Not a lot of people get their, you know, news agendas set in the morning by newspapers, right? It's totally different whether you're seeing an email on your phone or you're listening to a podcast or you're not consuming anything at all. Like, it's just everyone's news diet is 100% completely different. And I think that has been the major shift over the past 10 years.
Yeah. So a big theme of this podcast, I think, is that we're between eras, right? And what that next era is, it seems like it's going to be defined by AI. And we're obviously coming out of a particular era. I would say it's probably around scale and traffic. But do you have a theory of the case, Sarah? Because I'm interested in how you determine what you cover, because we've discussed this before, but it's just you covering media at Axios. So you could write about so many different things. And do you try to make sure that they map back to a big mega trend? And if so, what are they?
Yes. And I have two colleagues who help me cover a lot of things on deals, Tim Basinger and Gary Flynn. But I think the way we see it at Axios is, what does a smart professional need to know about media? And what could we deliver that is unique that others can't? So for example, I don't do content reviews because there are a million blogs out there that are going to do a better job than I can of reviewing the latest episode of whatever Game of Thrones or whatever show that it is. But where I think Axios has a lot of expertise is in the convergence of topics. So whether it's a trend in political media, I'm writing a story tomorrow with one of my colleagues in the politics desk about RFK's media coverage, or if it's a trend about deals and media or markets and media. Like, that's where I think Axios does really well, because we're small, nimble, subject matter expert focused, and we can team up to deliver like really smart insights, mostly for people who are trying to get smarter faster for their jobs. Where we're not as strong and where we don't really care to be as strong is like entertaining you with our coverage of the media. Like, I don't do consumer-based coverage on like, what's the hottest thing on Netflix right now?
You had made an amazing point to me the other day that on one side, you have the continuum, you have breaking news when you break a story. And then on the other side, you have what, Sarah? You have like point of view or trendist point of view or sort of in-depth, like a reported feature. And you're like the stuff in the middle, which is just sort of like aggregating up content for people has less and less relevance. Can you tell us a little bit about your thought on that kind of scale of things?
Yeah. There was a time when in the media business ecosystem, there was value in aggregating things quickly and providing them in a format where you could be optimized on Google search, you know, through AMP, accelerated mobile pages, or on Facebook instant articles and gather tons of traffic and make advertising revenue off of it. And now that we're shifting more towards, you know, consumer reader revenue with subscriptions or events or membership programs or even donations, like you need to offer things that are super distinct. So for Axios, we care a lot about scoops. We care a lot about things called like conceptual scoops, where it's not necessarily that I broke a story based off of sourced information. It's that I was the first to say something about a piece of data that nobody else had found. And those are novel things. You're only going to get them on our site. We hope to drive the conversation and then have other people aggregate them. You know, if there's something that's really huge that another news outlet will do, it will break, we'll still aggregate it and provide that service to our audience. But like our goal is to be distinct. And I think that there's more of a premium right now on distinctive journalism than ever before. I think there's more pressure right now on journalists to be really, really distinctive. And that's actually super refreshing, because I think for the past few years in the scaled traffic era, there was a lot more pressure to get clicks. And that led to, quite frankly, like a race to the bottom in terms of quality. Now, especially on the media beat, I look at Puck, I look at Semaphore, I look at all these upstarts that didn't exist a few years ago with incredible reporters doing really good journalism. Like that to me is amazing. That's what we're aspiring to do.
What's give me an example of a conceptual scoop that you're proud of recently.
I think a good example is we found data, we requested data, we went through a whole bunch of it to find what is the trajectory of growth in the ad market for Google and Meta? And is it slowing, and to what extent is it slowing and why? And what the data found is that for the first time, I think it was in 2022, whenever I wrote that story, 2023, they would be representing less than half of the digital ad market for the first time in 10 years. And if you were to take a look at the data for the next 10 years moving ahead, their piece of the ad pie is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, smaller as retailers like Amazon increase their presence. And so this notion of the duopoly, like it doesn't exist anymore. You know, they are no longer like the majority, the two of them. And so that was like combing through tons of data, representing it really well visually. We had a ton of news outlets from the Wall Street Journal all the way down to smaller trade blogs follow us and, you know, report on that data after we were the first to find it. And that's not necessarily someone coming to me and saying, hey, I have this great stuff. That's me going out and asking like, hey, what does this look like? What is the future trend? And then doing the work on the back end and sorting through the data.
Like the story today when someone mapped out time spent on the New York Times, and I know this might be debunked by you, Sarah, a little bit, but more than half of the time on the New York Times is now on their apps, I think is what where the data was from, is in games, more than half.
Was that app data? Was that...
It says global time spent for New York Times owned apps.
Yes. Well, there's this meme that the New York Times is really a games company with, you know, news at the front.
Here's what I would say about that. The New York Times is at this point, like far more revenue is coming from subscriptions than ads. And the way that they're really making money on subscriptions is bundling them together. And so, you know, you look at time spent, which is important for engagement and important for marketers, right? That you want to help them reach people through advertising. And that's an important metric. But what's more important is like how many new people are buying these subscriptions. That's the most key metric.
Fair enough, Sarah. But, you know, survey of one, I really like playing connections every morning and it keeps me loyal to the app.
Yeah.
And it is a really nice counterbalance to, you know, a lot of the trouble in the world. Yeah.
And also the Times shrank their
Do you see what they did today on connections? Do you guys play connections?
No.
What they do today?
Instead of words, you have to connect, you know, you have to connect conceptually different words together. And there's four rows of four, so there's 16 squares and you have to connect them. Today they did it with icons or like emojis. And you had to connect the different sort of like little tiny images. So the first time they'd ever done it and people went nuts and we had a good morning.
I mean, everyone's saying with that data, oh, the New York Times is a gaming company now. I mean, I think that the New York Times is a lifestyle services company in addition to a news company.
I got you. I totally get it. But, you know, every media business has a little hack, right? Has a dirty little secret, has the content that's just way more efficient than anything else. And like dollar for dollar, these are like extremely, you know, productive investments. And people like them, they're loyalty driving. I mean, it is worth noting that the biggest trend in modern media is that you fight for distribution. That's the mega trend in media, where you don't have a controlled system of distribution any longer. So things that create loyalty and things that bring people back are the things that you need to look for. And I think that that's what's important about this story. You know, one related thing, Brian, and I've brought this up a number of times, I can't tell you now how well Apple is using sports data as a way to get me to pay attention to them. So they'll say, I'll get a notification on my phone or on my television or on my computer that the Nets Lakers game is, or the Nets Golden State game is heating up, right? Like it's using a real time, you know, kind of data point to pull me into, you know, a service. And I think that's also representative of this trend. It's like you can't rely on the programming guide anymore, right? So you have to find ways to get people connected. And that's why I think it's an important story.
I mean, I agree, but the thing I want to stress is I'm looking right now at the New York Times investor letter for the year. If you think about the ARPU, the average revenue per user for the New York Times digital only subscriptions, the news subscriptions, that the amount of revenue that you're getting per news subscriber is $9.50. The amount of revenue you're getting from other single product subscriptions, whether that be games or cooking, is $3.50.
Right, so, but don't I get games with my New York Times sub, or do I pay for it separately?
Well, do you get the bundle? Yes.
The bundle is where they're, right? I mean, this is the success of the time. I mean, they've had a lot of success, and I don't know how replicable it is. And we haven't seen, so everyone goes to the New York Times as a success case, and it is a success case. But I don't know if it is a model that can be replicated, because it simply hasn't been. And why hasn't the Washington Post pulled off this model? Why didn't the LA Times pull off this model? It seems like it's sui generis.
Mostly because they don't have good apps and they haven't had good product thinking around it, I think.
Bundling we know works. It's just that the news industry has not figured it out perfectly. But we know it's working for music. We know it's working for retail, right? There's a reason why you get, you know, discounts for certain music or television streaming apps when you get your Walmart Plus subscription, right? Amazon, the entire Prime subscription is a bundle. So bundling works. I think the reason why it works for the Times is, like I said before, they're a lifestyle services company. They've figured out a target audience, which is mostly liberal elites, and they are serving them with things that they know they're going to like, intellectual games, cooking recipes, product reviews for high-end items. This works for their target audience. If you want to build out ancillary services for your audience, first of all, I think a lot of news companies don't know who their audience really is. That's the problem with the Washington Post. And second of all, if you want to build out ancillary services for them, you need to figure out what's endemic to their lifestyle and their habits. And I think a lot of news companies, because they don't know their audience, they don't even know where to go in building that. And that's their huge issue. I think the Journal and Dow Jones does a pretty smart job. They have figured out that their audience is smart professionals. And so they give B2B data and services for those smart professionals. And they sell enterprise bundles to people in the workforce. Like that is a strategy that actually works. So it's not just that the Times is the only one. I just think when we are comparing other national newspapers, most other national newspapers haven't figured that out. But there are some that are starting to get it.
Yeah. And I don't even know if there are any other national newspapers. The LA Times isn't a national. I don't know if the Washington Post.
I'd say
the Washington Post keeps going back and forth about whether.
Yeah. And that's their problem, right? USA Today would be the other national newspaper. But obviously, the bundle that you get as a part of that is just access to other hyper-local things, if you even care. But you're right. There's probably nothing that's paralleled on the newspaper front. On the national news website front, I mean, we've talked about this a lot, Brian. It's like, professional services journalism tends to do bundles really well with data and services and events and exclusive membership things. Non-professional services journalism for general audiences does not do so well.
Also, just a quick shout out to Al Newharth for his, I think it was Al Newharth, for the, because audience distribution hacks are not new. I mean, what a brilliant distribution hack to get every hotel in the country to deliver the USA Today to people's door. I mean, amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny in DC, a big hack that we all used to do when we were selling political subs was we would give them, we would make sure we had free distribution in Starbucks and coffee shops. At Politico, we did this. And that way we were able to increase the distribution that we could go to advertisers and say, look, we reached X amount of million people in Washington, D.C., when in reality, like, you don't actually reach those many people in print. You know what I mean? These are not people who are like actively paying for your paper. It's just you're dumping them for free wherever you can within the DC DMA.
Yeah. So give me, I want to talk about optimistic views of whatever this chaotic future is for media. We know the tech companies are going to be fine. I trust that. But publishing and media companies are really up against
it. Didn't we do the optimism episode already?
We could do it twice.
Did we? When did we do it?
All right.
You don't want to do optimism? All right, Sarah.
Well, it doesn't really sell.
Optimism sells.
I'll give you some hot and some cold. Here's what I think is hot, and here's what's optimistic. I think you got a lot of distressed properties finding better owners. So you think about Sports Illustrated coming under the umbrella of Minute Media, which is a unicorn.
It's crazy time over there. Crazy time.
I think about whoever takes on Paramount will be a better fit than it being publicly traded right now.
Authentic Brands sued him today.
Yeah, and they probably have a good lawsuit.
Who? The 5-Hour Energy guy?
Yeah.
5-Hour Energy guy, yeah.
And Ross sued him last week.
Oh, man, he's a real like hedgehog. He really gets into it, right?
Yeah, he's a hedgehog. Yeah.
You have a lot of distressed assets that have better owners. I mean, look at Yahoo and under Apollo is doing much better than it was under Verizon. I'm seeing a lot of optimism in women's sports and a huge market being developed around it, which is exciting.
So great, yeah.
We're seeing
that in the tournament, right? It's so great. The numbers are really strong.
They're very strong. I think for talent, it's a really good time because even though there's a lot of layoffs, which is unfortunate, we also are seeing a new trend where media companies recognize you can't just unilaterally hold on to people and not give them opportunities to branch out if you want to retain stars. So Stephen A. Smith has a podcast deal with Odyssey, but he's still on ESPN. Taylor Lorenz works at the Washington Post, but she's doing a podcast with Vox Media. Jonathan Lemire works at Politico, hosts a show on MSNBC. I think this is going to continue to be a trend of more talent flexibility, which is empowering for journalists. So there's like threads of good optimistic things that are happening, but I know you love to talk about the chaos, Brian.
No. I want to talk optimism. Troy doesn't want to talk about optimism, but I want to. Those are all good. Let's go back to the women's sports one because I find that really interesting. Because at first I wasn't sure whether this was a grassroots thing or whether this was like the brands want this to happen, but it's happening. What do you see? What is the? I mean, obviously cultural changes, and there's just some amazing stars happening right now. How does that trickle down to and change the media business?
You know what I think a huge part of it is, Brian, is that a big part of sports and you know, just watch the NFL to understand this is packaging, right? It's marketing and packaging. And I think that, you know, ultimately you're a sports fan. It's the drama that we create around something in the stories we tell and the way that we make it fun to watch. And finally, people are doing this for women's sports.
And we have this like once in a lifetime generational talent. Caitlin Clark is truly once in a lifetime. Has
totally
women's record.
But my take is that there's heroes in every tournament, right? There's always something. There's always a story. This is a particularly good one. I agree. But I think it's the way that we get people excited about the human narratives that make sports really addictive. I just think it's happening more because we decided to make it happen.
Well, what's happening is women are really good at social media. And if you take a look at the numbers on Instagram for women right now in sports, they are just crushing men. They know how to promote themselves on TikTok, on Instagram. And as such, they're developing stronger fan bases, which now actually has trickle-down effect because of NIL. So you see these women that are coming out with these massive deals in college, and then suddenly they're getting scouted and they're bringing those marketing partnerships with them to the WNBA, with them to the NWSL, and bringing the viewership and the fandom with them. And so when you see the NWSL striking this like landmark deal with four networks, Scripps, ESPN, Amazon, CBS, like that, I think actually does come from people following and being interested in the players. You're seeing so much momentum around women's clubs. It's unreal. They're selling at valuations that are just astronomical. The one concern though I have, and it's a huge problem for women's sports, it's also a problem for men's sports, is the leagues are so desperate to cash in that they're dividing their rights amongst so many players that I do worry it gets a little bit of burdensome on consumers who now are like, all right, where do I find this game? I'm a fan, but I don't even know where to access this. Oh, I don't have a subscription to that service. I need to get Prime to get this. There's a cost in the short term, I think, of divvying up the rights, but the overall deal packages are huge. Like numerically, they're making so much more money, these leagues are, for the women than they ever have in the past.
Mm-hmm. But that's also a story of the streaming marketplace, right? I mean, the unbundling ended up being, it got out of control for, I think, for consumers. It's hard to find anything. It's hard to know where anything is.
Yeah. And this is why I'm honestly kind of excited about the end of peak TV. There's that data that came out from FX that said last year was the first time, barring the pandemic, that the number of new original streaming shows has, or new original scripted shows has started to slow. I think consumers are being inundated with new stuff across way too many services. And so now hopefully if you have consolidation among services, if there's a little bit of a slowdown of new programming, like it allows consumers to take a breath. Whereas before it was getting, and even now, it was just so overwhelming.
I mean, I think overall we've reached peak content. Like the idea of creating more content in most categories, it's not a really compelling offer. And so maybe better would be.
A lot of battles going on too right now, right? That makes an interesting time in media. We have the sort of the mega battles like Kassin versus Zimmer or Ronan.
TikTok versus Universal Music.
I can't believe he started with the Michael Kassin one. But
or yeah. Rona McDaniels versus, you know, the people of NBC.
Or NBC's people of NBC against its management.
Yeah. Circling
or Nelson Peltz versus Bob Iger.
Yeah, that's a good one. We're going to get that proxy vote this Wednesday, which
yeah,
I think
that
Disney will pull through. But what is so interesting is there was this huge wave of activist pressure around media. Like even the New York Times had Value Act pressuring them and they weren't doing anything wrong with their strategy. You know, News Corp was getting pressure to divest Dow Jones or their real estate business. Like activists were coming out like crazy. And I think the success of the proxy vote on Wednesday with Nelson Peltz and Treon versus Disney could dictate whether or not activists continue to push, because a lot of them have been largely unsuccessful in these battles. The only one that's been somewhat successful has been Elliott Management. They put a lot of pressure under then Twitter and they got Jack Dorsey pushed out. They put a lot of pressure under Nielsen, eventually took it private. Like Elliott, they were the ones that pressured the divestiture of DirecTV. So Elliott wins, everyone else, not as much.
We have the epic battle to take over Disney too, right? We have Dana Walden versus, what's his name?
Pitaro.
Yeah, Pitaro from ESPN.
Yeah, we're starting
and then
to
we have
trials come out.
Sherry Redstone versus the world versus, you know, whoever is going to pick apart that carcass.
I think Skydance, KKR, and Redbird probably gets that bid because she doesn't. Apollo, we reported, was interested. There were reports that Apollo wants that movie studio and TV studio.
Paramount, yeah.
She doesn't want to sell it in pieces. I mean, she just wasted all of her political capital trying to bring these firms together. To only sell them in pieces like 5 years later is. She doesn't want that. And I think that they'll try to get out the whole thing.
Yeah. So what is your take on where the cable business ends up going? I mean, obviously it is YouTube TV is emerging as the big winner, but who else is a winner here?
That's a good question. I mean, you have the leagues still investing in cable. So the NFL in particular, I mean, they signed an 8-year deal with ESPN not so long ago. We'll see how ESPN deals with that once they break out their like flagship network, which is basically they're taking their cable network and separating it from the bundle. In 2025, they say they plan to do that. I think that could have a huge impact on what happens with the bundle. But I think for the most part, you have to wait until the existing sports rights contracts expire. And I just don't foresee them, even the newer ones that we're going to have to wait for, NBA this year, I just don't foresee them lacking a cable component. I think it's pretty clear that we're going to get something either on ESPN or TNT. And so the cable doesn't collapse until that happens. And by the way, the floor for that, if you were to just say, okay, let's say everyone leaves cable but sports fans, analysts will tell you that that's about 50 to 55 million households. That's still massive. Like most streamers would kill to have 50 to 55 million subscribers domestically. So it's dying a slow death. It's not going away like overnight. I think the bigger shift that's going to happen is once we do decide, okay, it's done, you have to figure out how you're going to make as much money in the non-cable world as you did the streaming world. And I think that's going to be very hard for most companies.
Oh my God, totally. What's your take on the FAST world and things like Tubi?
It's just the if you look at the numbers, right, the CPM, the cost per 1,000 impressions that you could get on a cable television ad is nowhere near that in streaming. Simply because one, we don't have the scale and we're trying to sell everything in such a targeted manner. You cannot even though you can charge a higher CPM, a higher rate for a more targeted ad, you're not selling as large volume on those more targeted ads. And so I just think all of these companies are going to find themselves in a perilous position. They're not going to just take all of the TV ad revenue. It's not going to work that way. So there's going to have to be consolidation amongst those players, or they're going to have to figure out how to drive value outside of just advertising, which, you know, some are experimenting with all these crazy things like shopping and TV and affiliate. And it, I don't think much of that honestly ends up working. I think
you
Amazon
to shop also, on the TV when you I can think, shop on your computer and it's right there, or on your phone.
I think the companies that can marry like strong retail data with connected advertising, full funnel inventory, like an Amazon Prime, will do just fine. And they will.
But that's a data play. That's not a shopping play, right? That's validation for, you know,
you need
advertising
the shopping data,
performance.
Though.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But I'm just saying the act of actually shopping on your TV doesn't seem very realistic.
No, I don't think it's very realistic.
I can hardly put my password in on the TV. You know, with your remote, it's pretty hard.
You don't have to with the QR codes and whatnot these days.
I don't think any of that works. I think everyone's saying like, oh, it's all about ad-supported streaming TV. This is where the momentum is. And I agree. I just cannot foresee most companies' free ad-supported streaming services ever bringing them the type of money that they got from their very lucrative cable networks. And that could be the death for a lot of big entertainment companies.
Yeah. And it's also hard to measure. I mean, the media business always just flees to the area that measurement has not caught up yet. And then just go on to the next
area. You know
what
we should talk about, though? I got to say, you have all these upstarts trying to take on Nielsen. You have the iSpots and the video amps. And yeah, they're striking these deals with TV companies. But if you talk to the NFL, they're not using any of those.
It's
they're
Nielsen.
Still going with Nielsen. And so I will say, the death of Nielsen has been greatly exaggerated, or whatever that expression is. That's true.
I have a 401k from Nielsen because they owned Adweek when I was there. I actually worked under the Boeing guy. He was running Nielsen. And then he went to run Boeing. I don't know if that experience helped him in running Boeing. Yeah, no, Nielsen has always been ever since I started covering this industry, everyone was talking about how backwards Nielsen is and how it needs to be replaced. And guess what? Never has been.
No.
No.
Well, it was also a week of sort of Vice stories. Did you guys notice that? Did you read the one?
Yeah,
in
I read
the
Verge that
today?
Like long one. That was like really strange.
And Shane apparently coming back in to buy up some assets.
I love Shane.
Fortress.
There was one story in the Hollywood Reporter, and
Jesse
and a
caught a few
rap.
Strays in that Verge story.
He did, but he also, you know, he responded.
He did. I like that. He had a really pointed quote. I wouldn't have buried that in that story. He sort of threw the two co-CEOs under the bus.
I'm curious to see what happens to some of these other assets, like Refinery 29 being sold to Essence, possibly. There's still a few other things that need to get shaken out. I think Carly Kloss bought ID. You know, there's what's going to be left. I'm not sure, but there's still a few things that need to be sold.
Yeah, they'll sell the agency and they'll sell a few other things. I mean, it's like going to be salvage operation, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. Like Refinery sold in 2019 for $400 million. I don't think that they're going to get more than $40 million.
I think Justin and Phillip should buy it back. If you're listening, Justin and Phillip, buy it back.
They don't want to, Brian.
You know what? That's an interesting
No, but they should be forced to.
That's an interesting, though, trend, Brian. If you think about Network Buying Complex, they brought back all the originals to come in and run the place.
Yeah. Moksha. And the editor guy, they brought him back.
Yeah.
They didn't bring Rich back. Rich Antonelli. They didn't
no,
bring
Rich
back.
Doesn't want to be back. I asked someone and he said he's done.
No, he's operating. Too busy doing hustle posts on LinkedIn.
Yeah. And I think that you have some people who are looking at their old, you know, distressed now assets. And they're thinking like, if I could go back in there, I could just make it better. I could just fix it.
I think Reed Hastings has the right idea. He's going to open a ski club in Powder Mountain. He just bought Powder Mountain. That's a good call. Come on. Your victory lap is owning Powder Mountain. That's a good idea, don't you think?
Sounds nice.
Buying a mountain sounds like a great idea if you got the money. Is that a future, the distressed asset? Because unfortunately, I want to make this optimistic, but there are a lot of media brands are really just brands at this point, and they're going to be bought for the brand. And you know what Authentic Brands Group has done with various, you know, they do it outside of media too. That playbook is going to be run on a lot of quote-unquote storied, quote-unquote iconic brands, it seems to me.
I mean, I think I feel as though Forbes is in that category. Jess Sibley's done a lot of really smart things at Time, but I think Time, in a sense, is in that category. Like, it's no longer about the premium journalism anymore. You're not going you don't think of Forbes as being like the steward of all the big breaking stories in business. Now
they do catch a few now and then.
They do.
Their tech coverage is good.
Tech coverage is good and great coverage.
I think you need to give Forbes a little more credit.
I wonder why you care so much.
Troy's a Forbes stan for some unknown reason. No, I like Forbes. I mean, what am I saying? I like Forbes.
The business is really, you know, heading into a trajectory time too, right? Where it's these like branded summits, you know, Forbes 30 under 30, Forbes 50 under 50, Forbes 30 under 30 Asia, right?
Like,
don't
forget the billionaires list.
Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
Billionaires Azerbaijan.
Business. Yeah. Same thing with time, right? It's like time 100 AI, time 100 climate.
Yeah. I just think the feed on Forbes is a little more robust. So I give them credit for that. I mean, look at it. You can do the time thing, right? Which, you know, Jess has done a good job of bringing some urgency to the revenue side through largely through activations and the power of the brand. Or you could go the Atlantic route. And the Atlantic route is to invest in heavy journalism and you know, try to find a path to subscribers and do it on the back of, you know, a patient philanthropic owner. And I think the Atlantic has done a good job of that, right? And I think by the time Jess got to Time, it was like, let's make money now because we spent too much money, even though I am, you know, a rich guy. So, you know, when Mark hired Jess to be the CEO of Time, it was money time.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, there just wasn't the appetite for the kind of journalistic investment required to put that brand, you know, to bring it to a different place.
Yeah, I just think there's a different ethos and drive in some of the new upstarts on the news side. Like when you think about Scoops, you're thinking Puck, you're thinking Semaphore, you're thinking Axios, you're thinking Politico, you're thinking like these newer punch bowl, right? Like that's their whole value add is just breaking news. And then when you take a look at some of these more legacy assets, we used to be those people who broke all that news. And now we are sophisticated brands that can curate, you know, experiences and people. And that is our value add. And I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with it. I just think there's probably a happy medium between the two of being able to curate those stages and experiences, but also stay relevant enough day to day.
Yeah. Although I would say, you know, magazines were the original conceptual scoop machines, really.
Yeah.
I mean, because it was a weekly. I mean, I grew up reading Time magazine and there weren't a lot of choices. There was no internet. So it was a way to put in context all of what is going on in the world. I think the business models to support that now are, you know, difficult.
You know what magazines are now? They are marketing. If you talk to anybody who's still printing magazines, mm-hmm. they've reduced the distribution. They do a thicker, more beautiful quarterly, and they want it to sit on your coffee table as a marketing experience so that you will buy into their other
your products. Souvenirs. You know, I feel like we have the truth speaker on the pod today. She's the speaker of the hard truths.
Hard
You're
truths
totally
for
right.
Sarah Fisher. That should be your brand extension. Tell Jim that this superstar journalist trend was highlighted. Jim, if you're listening.
You know what's funny? We did a series at Axios called Hard Truths, and it was one of the hardest things we ever had to do. It was forcing all of our subject matter experts to do deep dives on DEI on our beats. And that was really, really, really enlightening. I think one of the big hard truths that we figured out was just like there's so little investment in minority-owned media right now, and always has been. But then, you know, there was an era during Black Lives Matter where you had Group Black and you had Capital B was started, which is actually doing very well. And that seems to have died down. There's also something we're tracking closely at Axios, which is like the anti-DEI backlash and what that means for investments in like minority media. But so the Hard Truths brand is already an Axios brand. I can't take credit.
There you go. You can take it over. Maybe. I don't know if you want to pivot away from the original DEI focus. But yeah, I mean, look, that was always, I don't want to say it was a zero interest rate phenomenon, but when times get tough, that stuff can sometimes, unfortunately, get cut. And I mean, Group Black never bought anything. I'm still waiting.
Yeah, but they're still, you know, in the game, aren't they? I was delighted to hear that friend of PVA, Vivek Shah, had actually made a significant investment in Group Black.
Yes, he did.
And I thought that was super cool. He told me that last time I saw him.
I'm very curious to see what he does in all of, you know, Ziff Davis, what they do in buying a bunch of properties. I think that there's more to come there. They bought Lifehacker, right?
Yeah. I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the real, to me, like on the publishing side, a really interesting thing is who the buyers that emerge. Because you have, you know, Ziff has a really, you know, for publishing, it's a very successful model, right? And some of their properties are very different than the types of properties we talk here about a lot here, but they make money. And, you know, there's a lot of areas of the media business that are nicely profitable, and they're just run differently from other the other parts of the media industry that tend to get more focus.
You know, the roll-up business is really hard. Like, Outside has tried to do this with outdoor lifestyle magazines. They had big backing from Sequoia. They raised $150 million Series B. Yeah. They later had to do layoffs because it's hard. Arena Group, you're seeing, is a whole other issue, but that was a roll-up, a publicly traded roll-up that's struggling big time. You have Recurrent Ventures, which is like a sort of like a private equity-based digital roll-up company. We reported countless times that they're having layoffs. And so like the idea that you could roll up a bunch of digital brands, put behind them shared technology and back-end services and power them is, it's proving to be harder than I think a lot of folks took into account. And what I think Ziff Davis, or I guess, what are they now? Are they Ziff2 now? J2? Ziff Davis? Whatever
no,
we call
it. They changed to J2 for a small period of time, but then they were like, nobody knows what this is, even for a B2B brand.
They're smart because it's not just publications, right? It's like back-end services. It's technology companies. It's diverse.
The grimier, the closer you get to the grime, the more profits, for sure. Yep. Anywhere with a call center, you know that they're... I'm sure there's call centers involved in Ziff. Troy, do you know if there's call centers?
It wouldn't surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise you.
That means that there's an operational complexity. They run data businesses. They run, you know, complex, you know, service content-based businesses, Everyday Health and others. So, you know, I think it's probably, there's a call center nestled in there somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with the call center. There's a lot
of rebooting will have a call center soon.
I'm happy to have a call center in Ireland calling people up in order to get leads and whatnot. No problem. So give me an optimistic take on these negotiations between AI companies and the media.
Oof, I'm not super optimistic about it. So, you know, I cover the trade organizations because I'm here in DC. If the industry came out with a very united front, they'd have a ton of leverage. But what happened was the New York Times sues OpenAI, claiming billions of dollars worth of damages. And its peers start striking these deals for, you know, so much significantly less. It really is pulling the wind out of their sails. And we know News Corp and OpenAI are going to strike a deal that's like coming pretty soon. When that happens, you know, they're not going to disclose how much, but you can imagine it's like similar to the Axel deal, right? We're not talking hundreds of millions of dollars, probably tens of millions of dollars. It makes it so much harder for the New York Times to convince a judge that they deserve billions when their most direct rival is accepting tens of millions. And so I think you're going to continue to see these one-off deals. Eventually, years from now, New York Times, OpenAI get settled in court. It's somewhere in between what they're asking and the tens of millions that their peers are settling for. And as an industry, would have been much better off going in as a united front. And we tried it. Barry Diller tried to pull that coalition together and it failed, in part because everybody has such disparate interests. And we didn't do it.
Yeah.
That'll bite us.
So the economics change then of the industry.
Yeah.
Or we don't know.
Well, I think that let's say the New York Times sued OpenAI and not a single other media company struck a deal with an AI company, they would then be by default the position of the industry. But because that's not what happened, but because dozens of news outlets are likely going to strike these deals at a far smaller rate than what the New York Times is alleging in damages, they're not the default position of the industry. And it makes it harder for a judge to side with as high of a number that they're demanding.
But let's, you know, even bigger picture. I think you're right, Sarah. But I think that no industry was ever saved by suing the next frontier of a consumer service into oblivion. I just think it's incredibly short-term thinking, right? So if it's a question of, is there an extra toll here that's going to make marginal improvement in my P&L? Great. The fact is that we're in the middle of a shift in how people get information. And, you know, we're going to have to differentiate the kind of stuff that we create so that it's different from what the machines, you know, suck up. That's just how it goes. And the idea that Barry Diller would get 5, 10, 20 media companies together. There's hundreds of them. There's hundreds of them that all want a piece, that all think they deserve more than they're going to get. The idea that an AI company is going to become the central bank for media is insane.
I totally agree with you. Here's how my brain sees it. There's a reason why you have, let's look at the streaming world right now. If you are not considered a traditional paid TV company, you are not required by law to have direct negotiations with local networks. There's a huge regulatory battle about this right now because that could really undermine the streaming industry's business. A similar thing is happening here. I'm not saying that OpenAI becomes a central bank, but I think sometimes small legal or regulatory definitions do help you define and carve out your business model moving forward. And I do think that this New York Times OpenAI case will set the standard.
Okay. Whether or not it's for the good really or bad, what we're fighting about is there was a distribution mechanism that we tuned media businesses to that existed for a long time. And I, by the way, will exist for a long time in the future. And
you mean search?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's like people, it's not going to get switched off immediately. Listen, if you want to find like all that a page created by, you know, a motivated, intelligent person is a formatted query when you think about it, right? Like it's a page still has value. Just because the machine can crunch up a bunch of information and spit it back at you doesn't mean that it's always going to be better than something that was created thoughtfully by, you know, loving hands. So, you know, I just think that A, it's going to happen way slower than you think. I think we get caught up in, you know, I mean, it was like the old, you know, the joke at our dinner, Brian, when our good friend Reed said to you, hey, Brian, like, slow your roll. Perplexity, are you kidding me? AOL still makes $400 million or something like that. You know, like
EBITDA. $300 million. I thought it was revenue.
Well, I don't think
I was impressed with revenue.
My point is things change more slowly than you think. And
dial-up service.
That's the whole model of private equity, right? It's like you take distressed assets and you squeeze them for their profits faster than you foresee them declining. That's why private equity firms are gobbling up like distressed newspapers and like TV outlets.
Yeah, that particular play has been.
I agree.
Sarah, Troy is very pro private equity, so watch where you.
I'm anti naivety.
I'm a capitalist. It's fine. Yeah. But no, I agree that it's not, the spigot isn't going to turn overnight. And you're already seeing like OpenAI is starting to pay, you know, again, not that we need to be relying on their funds to fuel our industry, but there you're starting to see there is a bit more of a thought towards fair value exchange, right? They're paying now Axel Springer for real-time news results and their queries. But I think you're right. Like the news industry has to figure out how they're going to fit into this. Like we can't just expect the handouts.
Okay, guys. Yeah. You're going to see a lot of evergreen content get gobbled up because it's low value. And in the future, it's going to be functionally better inside of a chat interface. You're going to see a lot of snippets of articles that actually perform similar functions to what search did, right? They're citations and they still drive traffic. Yeah. You're going to see these new platforms as you have today, like Perplexity, start running advertising when they become, you know, traffic brokers or attention brokers for hungry businesses that want to buy us the game with money, which is the history. All of that will keep existing. It just will manifest in different ways.
Totally. And just on the search thing, there was a time when if the New York Times published a 20,000 word story and the HuffPost aggregated a 150 word story with a huge headline from one sentence in that 2,000 word New York Times piece, they would get a higher search rank, right, depending on the query, than the Times would that broke the story. Because at the time, that's how Google's algorithm was prioritizing what was best and most relevant for the reader. And so what did the Times have to do? They had to pivot to subscriptions, right? They had to pivot their business model around something else. Like the same thing's gonna happen. For those who publish the evergreen content, they're now going to be doing affiliate more and they're gonna be doing events more. Look at Dotdash. Expanding the food and wine festivals, right? This is the direction it's going. They know that their evergreen content will get eaten. They'll just have to move to something else that they don't feel like they have to compete with the AI platforms on. It's just a question of who can execute and who can do it fast enough.
Yeah. I think Neil Vogel is the face of the rebellion. You know, Neil Vogel was on the podcast. He's one of the great book talkers of all time. He's quasi-religious in the way he presents his company. It's awesome.
Okay, well, he's got zeal. That's good. What about upstarts? We need upstarts, right? Who are upstarts that you're excited about? Because I can remember in the previous generation, you know, Axios was an upstart. You know, at the time, like BuzzFeed and Vox. Unfortunately, those are, you know, those models didn't do so well. There's some smallish things happening right now. I would classify Semaphore and Puck as kind of smallish, and I think that's indicative of where this industry is going. But who are upstarts that you think are going to define sort of what comes next?
I think it's the hyper niche that's able to make it right now. Angler, and entertainment, payload and space, punch bowl and politics. Like go 404 and tech, like go super niche, give yourself license to expand from there, be a little bit profitable, don't borrow too much money. That I think is what we're going to see in the future. If you try to, you know, raise a ton of money and do everything at once, like messenger style.
But some money is good money. You know,
Troy loves high cost capital.
Yeah, Sarah, smart.
If
money.
You watch yourself, he'll try to foist some on you before the end of the show.
Let's go back to Minute Media. There are some businesses that have proven a niche value add. Like Minute Media specifically caters to sports publishing tech. Like that is niche, but because they do it well, they have found a way to take on sizable investments. I mean, FanDuel, I think, put in a few dozen million in the last round.
Yeah.
Could be able to put something out that's pretty meaningful. I mean, it's a big, successful business.
So yeah, they're making it seemingly work. I just, the history of combining this, we're a platform, but we have publishers operating on it is a little checkered, but I hope they make it work.
That was my line.
What? That is checkered?
No, well, the platforms, right? You used to challenge me on that all the time. And it turns out that we were both right.
Well, Troy was doing this like a generation ago. Is it a generation ago at this point?
We were OG platform media, yeah. Same media.
Remember when people were calling them platishers? Were you a platisher?
Yeah, remember the clean campaign?
I think there are a lot of people who have gotten out of that. Vox has completely ditched their tech efforts. The one I'm waiting on, like when does the Washington Post sell ARC? Like that is almost 10 years coming and still not profitable. That should be done at some point or sold.
What about a couple of hot takes from Sarah? Because you're like amazing. So I wouldn't mind throwing a couple at you.
Oh, give me some of your hot takes.
No, I want to get them from you, Sarah.
Oh, from me? Well, what kind of topic?
Well, let's get your hot take on Threads.
On Threads?
Yeah.
Wow. I don't think that engagement is nearly as good as they might pretend it to be. I think
when your inaugural tweet or thread or whatever is all right, let's do this thing from AOC, it makes me want to kill myself.
I just think that everyone has tried to unseat X and they haven't done a great job of doing it. X has fundamentally changed. We're still heavily reliant. I actually was scrolling through X, screenshotting all the publishers that were running ads now on X. I saw The Information, I saw Puck, like, it was just a temporary blip that people said they were going to boycott.
Puck seems to like X. I see their ads on there.
Yeah. I think X is doing, it's holding its ground. You're seeing all these competitors shudder. I don't foresee it being unseated by anyone, particularly not like Truth Social. The Truth Social numbers that came out today are like so sad. That's the biggest meme stock of all time.
It's ridiculous. It's not even worth covering.
What are your thoughts on the Reddit IPO?
I think
you said you were going to buy it.
Well, you buy it for one day. Because that's the trend. Listen, I think you made the point, Brian, not long ago, that if it was easy to create a sort of high yield, high functioning, scalable ad model around it, they would have done it. It's a really difficult challenge. You have to, maybe it's slightly different time now. I think that there's a lot of intent in there. And that's what really matters if you want a high value performance ad product. So Google obviously deals in intent. They're the intent arms dealer of the world. Facebook has the big machines that turns browsing into intent, and they're able to optimize to give you performance. Reddit has a lot of forums where someone's like reviewing a credit card or something. This is a high intent environment. So I think that there's an opportunity for them to grow their position significantly. Jen Wong is super smart. I'm optimistic about that, but they have a long way to go and they're trading at a really big multiple. So I think it comes back down to earth. I think we need to see a couple quarters of solid over 20% growth and then we can decide, Sarah, Brian, that would be my take.
Okay.
It's just funny. You watch like the Pinterest of the world and Pinterest stock is reliant at this point on rumors that Google's going to buy it. I think that's what becomes of Reddit, right? It's not going to grow fast enough for it to be on its own, this high-performing, publicly traded company. Its value, I think, is going to come from other bigger giants becoming interested in trying to buy it. What's different now, though, versus a few years ago with the Pinterest rumors is, and again, I don't know who's going to be president come November, the antitrust climate is so different. So if you're Reddit, it used to be that maybe in a year or two after I don't know, quasi okay ad growth, your stock could spike on a buying rumor from a big rival tech firm. Like nowadays, it's really hard to get bought by a big rival tech firm because of the antitrust climate.
Just for clarity on the Reddit thing, guys, the big ad machinery stuff that drives performance for small ROI focused advertisers is really, really investment intensive and really hard. Okay. It's really hard to do. And I don't think you're going to see a bunch of big brands suddenly step in and say, oh my God, Reddit, what a wonderful environment for my brand messaging. The way the revolution starts at Reddit is small people with things to sell find, you know, and performance-oriented marketers find ways of getting ROI out of Reddit. And the question is, are they going to have the savvy and the investment levels and the machinery to kind of harness that kind of performant advertisers where they're developing, you know, thousands of advertisers, not the business of, you know, the 100 that go to Cannes.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, the answer is no right now. I mean,
it's no. So, I mean, TBD on
but this. I mean, like, look at Snap. Snap has been trying to get at this since, what, 2018 when they went public, 2017. They are a $4.7 billion ad business. That's not nothing, but it's not massive. You know, Meta is well over $100 billion ad business. I think it's a hard world to compete in.
Okay. Yeah. Let's actually leave it there.
Let's do it. And maybe we'll finish. And maybe Sarah will even have a point of view on this. But I could do the good product corner.
Do you have something for good product? Do you know this corner?
You know, this episode kind of jumped out of nowhere. But I could pull something out of my ear. I would start it by congratulating W Magazine on their Beyoncé cover.
The digital cover.
The digital cover, whatever.
Sign of the
times. So that'll give Brian Goldberg something.
Yeah, because Brian sells based on like how many people pass it around, right?
Right. So clearly Beyonce is a goddess. And I'm not like, you know, oh my God, I have every Beyonce album and I do all that thing. But I listened to the album twice today. And it's called Cowboy Carter. It's a double album. It's, you know, this a little bit perplexing in that it's kind of half country and half, you know, other stuff. But Beyonce has this way of kind of making albums that are events. They're big and they're about power, you know, and they're about ambition and they're about challenging our views on social systems and the, you know, racial relationships. And I just think that it's an incredibly impressive album. There's a single on it called Texas Hold'em that's number one on the Hot Country Songs chart. She involved this woman named Linda Martell, this black country singer who's had an album, I think, in 1970 called Color Me Country, which she was the first charting country hit by a black woman. I don't know if you guys have heard the Miley Cyrus duet. I think it's called Most Wanted. It's an amazing song.
I'll be your shotgun rider till the day I die. Smoke out the window, flying down the 405. I'll be a backseat baby, driving you crazy anytime you like. Whoa, I'll be.
There's a Post Malone song on there, it's kind of fun. And her interpretation of Dolly Parton's classic Jolene is definitely worth listening to. So the good product this week would have to be this Cowboy Carter release from Beyonce.
Okay.
Good one.
I haven't listened to it. So.
Are you a fan, either of you?
No.
Yeah, definitely.
Brian, do you listen to like Steely Dan or something? What's your jam?
Steely Dan, mostly Steely Dan.
Dire Straits, is that?
I don't. I don't rush to get the new Beyonce album. I'll listen to it.
See what you think.
Thank you all for listening. And if you like this podcast, I hope you do. Please leave us a rating and review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast that takes ratings and reviews. Always like to get those. And if you have feedback, do send me a note. My email is bmorrissey@therebooting.com. Be back next week. This is a great episode.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Sarah. You're the best.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.